I'm Ellen Nickmeyer. I'm an AP reporter, and I'm very pleased to help bring some very good panel members for this session on the Clean Water Act and the Clean Water Rule. The Clean Water Rule, and just, you know, how far the jurisdiction of the Clean Water Act extends to the waters of the U.S. has become kind of a very heated issue and a matter of extensive court litigation. Proponents of kind of defining the Clean Water Rule say it's essential to extending protections to waters that provide drinking water for 117 million Americans, and the issues of protecting tributaries from runoff has become kind of evident when you look at the Lake Erie algal bloom that knocked out drinking water for 500 million people in Ohio and the eastern U.S. And it's an issue in California and from the Chesapeake Bay to the Gulf of Mexico. So, and the thing that is great about this panel is we have people who are on the front lines of deciding the implementation of the Clean Water Act and the Clean Water Rule. Not analysts, not reporters, but people who are kind of slugging it out in their diplomatic ways out in the field. So I'm going to start with John Duarte, who's a farmer in Northern California, and he runs the biggest agricultural nurseries in the States, in the U.S. John recently bought 450 acres and was going to try, this is my understanding, correct me if it's wrong, was going to try to get a wheat crop out of it before he turned it to orchards, and hired someone to plow it. And a U.S. Army Corps of Engineer project manager happened to drive by, saw the plowing, and believed that it threatened some wetlands on the land. And that he got a cease and desist order, and that's led to a lot of litigation that's made John and one of the symbols of farmers' worries about and objections to the implementation of the Clean Water Act. So I'd like to start with, if John could take kind of 3 to 5 minutes to kind of explain his thoughts on his interaction with those issues.
It's not very deep. It's not very, very massive. And in terms of moving any kind of earth, we got a call from an Army Corps of Engineers, a field agent, who said, "We see that you're deep ripping, and right through burrow holes." So, no, we're not deep ripping. We're planning deep. Deep ripping a vernal pool, in the case of this property, could be a low spot in the grass. It can be a spot in the grass with a, you know, in wet years can have a little bit different biology in it. In certain plants, where the water pockets after rainstorms, it can have different hydrological plant families. And if you plant wheat through these pools, shallow tillers, they redevelop into their natural state after a couple of years when you stop growing wheat. And that is the case for this property. If you deep rip a vernal pool, you might be, and I think this field agent in his report thought we're deep ripping 3 feet deep. If you deep rip them, you can destroy the topography of the vernal pool that allows it to collect water, this 2-inch depression in the grass. Or you can bust out the subsoil below the vernal pool that perches the water, and it will drain. It will no longer ever perch water again and support the types of biology it supports natively. We weren't doing that. We didn't till 36 inches. We didn't deep rip. The Department of Justice and the Army Corps of Engineers sent out an expert team of 10 people for 10 days with a large tracked excavator. They dug holes in the vernal pools. They, 2-3 feet deep, far deeper than we did. They studied the tillage through the property, and their Department of Justice expert report clearly says the tillage was 4 to 7 inches deep, exactly as we'd stated to them before. They went on to say after that we had destroyed wetlands, although our tillage was exactly consistent with previous wheat crops that had been farmed on the ground, because we left, quote, many mountain ranges in the furrow passes. So as we passed through these vernal pools and tilled them up for the wheat crop, there were little humps between the plow furrows. That's what you get when you plow. It's oftentimes a symbol of agriculture itself, as the furrows off into the horizon. The report claimed that the bottom of the furrow, with a tape measure coming across the peaks and one tape measure probing down to the valley of the furrow, 5 inches. The bottom of the furrow was still a wetland, but the top of the furrow was now, quote, a mini mountain range and was converted upland. The, digest that as you will. And initially, the expert report had an appraiser come in and say, well, the present value, you know, this was destined to be a walnut orchard without any further environmental review of wetlands. We know we've planted vineyards on rolling grasslands before. We know how to get the delineation done. We know how to go around the vernal pools when it does come to deep ripping and establishment of permanent crops. And that is what we would have done had we gone to an orchard, was that our tillage was imminently in preparation for a walnut orchard. And although we hadn't deep ripping over the same ground would have been inevitable, and we would have put a walnut orchard in, and it would have had a present value of X million dollars had we done this. So the fine should be X million dollars against the Duarte family for farming acreage that had been farmed in the exact same system many times before. Well, after a while, they decided that no, 4 to 7 inch tillage is enough, not really an imminent preparation for a walnut orchard. You can just plant wheat, and you can plant walnut on fully delineated ground and avoid the wetland features if you're going to keep to do that. So the fine stayed the same, but instead of the justification being the present value of a walnut orchard and its income stream being different than that of grazing and wheat land, it simply became, send us your financial statements. What do we think your family's worth? How big a fine do we think we can charge you? So currently, we're farming what might be 40 acres of vernal pools on a 450-acre property, all of which has been farmed many times before, and which the Farm Service Agency has documented as farmed wetlands. And we're paying to preserve this farmed wetlands as late as 2006 with payments. The current recommended fine by the Department of Justice and the Army Corps is $2.8 million in direct penalty and the purchase of 60 wetland credits in addition to fees to maintain them into perpetuity. I think our best estimate is they're asking for $8 to $10 million off of my family's balance sheet for simply farming through wetlands that have been farmed through many times before, and creating, quote, many mountain ranges. I've joked with my attorneys and called it Sierra de minimis. If every farmer in America who's currently in the Conservation Reserve Program, idling acreage in down markets and answering market demands as we did, recall in 2010, 11, and 12, there were world food shortages. America was in the Great Recession. Food inflation was impacting American consumers severely. The Arab Spring popped up partially or greatly due to food shortages in the Middle East. Down in Mexico City, they had tortilla riots because of the cost of corn and tortillas. Was kind of going through the roof. So we were simply taking ground that had been idled under the Conservation Reserve Program and bringing it back into production in the same production systems it had been farmed with previously to answer the market demands of global food needs. And we are now subject to $8 million in fines. So I'm going to assume that that will stir questions. It'll reveal more. And turn it over to Mike.
Okay. Thank you, John. Our next speaker is Jan Goldman Carter. She's has decades of experience with the National Wild Federation, which has been at the front of litigation and other efforts surrounding the Clean Water Act. Jan brings the national perspective to our panel. She's in her areas of focus. She's involved in issues from the Chesapeake Bay to the Great Lakes, the Gulf of Mexico. So I'd like Jan to give us her interaction with the Clean Water Act now.
Thanks. So can you all hear me? I could spend, you know, half an hour sort of doing a other side of the story on the Mr. Duarte's particular fact situation, but we can do a little bit of that in the Q&A. But Ellen had asked me to give a national perspective, and so I want to step back from that and just make a few comments. So first, thank you all for the opportunity to participate on behalf of the National Wildlife Federation. I want to just say, for starters, you know, public discourse on clean water and the Clean Water Act really should not be a rumble. It shouldn't be about this back and forth over whose spin controls, because there really is too much at stake. There are some very serious threats. You see a lot of information in the back on nitrate pollution here in California to our drinking water and our waterways nationwide, threats that are heightened by extreme weather, drought, flooding, and warming waters. And the fact of the matter is that the Clean Water Act has been a huge success and is our primary tool for keeping our waters clean and healthy and clarifying which waters are and are not waters of the U.S. Subject to the protections of the Act is really fundamental to the enforcement, the fair and consistent enforcement of the Clean Water Act and its effectiveness. So I want to just speak to two broad threats very quickly. One is that are very timely, very much involved in the news. You're probably hearing about it elsewhere today. And those are our aging drinking water and sewage treatment infrastructure, mm-hmm. And then nitrate and phosphorus pollution. Mm-hmm. And I really want to focus on the opportunity. We have a real opportunity right now. Many of you all are probably aware of this, to reinvest in the nation's water infrastructure in a way that adds jobs, supports local economies, protects public health, protects the drinking water of, you know, children and people all over the country, and helps to build resilience and, for communities, fish and wildlife, and outdoor recreation facing the extremes of flood and drought. So on the second threat, the threat of toxic algal blooms, dead zones caused by excessive nitrogen and phosphorus pollution, much of it is from intensive row crop agriculture and concentrated animal feedlots. A lot of it's from our own manure, our own sewage. So we all have a responsibility here. Just 2 days ago, and I think this is timely, and I hope it's something you all will pay attention to, EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, issued a call to arms to the states who are on the front lines of these threats. And I'd just like to quote briefly from the memo because it's worded better than I could myself. So the memo starts with, nutrient pollution remains one of the greatest challenges to our nation's water quality and presents a growing threat to public health and local economies, contributing to toxic, harmful algal blooms, contamination of drinking water sources, and costly impacts on recreation, tourism, and fisheries. Listen to this, because I think it's important. Recognizing the important roles, responsibilities, and authorities of all levels of government, industries, agriculture, non-governmental organizations, academia, and the public, the Office of Water will continue to foster and support partnerships and collaboration, which are critical to making sustained progress on reducing this significant threat to water quality and public health. And then the memo goes on to outline an announcement, EPA announcement, to support state planning and implementation of watershed-based multi-stakeholder projects to reduce impacts to public health, specifically from nitrates in sources of drinking water and from nitrogen and phosphorus pollution contributing to harmful algal blooms. This is a call for collaborative action and not the sound of federal overreach. And yet this federal overreach theme is the one, is the narrative that continues to be the drumbeat on the side of the Farm Bureau, in my view, in particular. So this collective concerted action requires changing a lot. It requires changing agricultural practices, and it will not happen without sustained public attention to some very tough questions. Who is responsible for this pollution? And this is not about blaming farmers. It's about shared responsibility for both the problems and the solutions. And who is paying for this pollution? In dollars, it's local, state, and federal taxpayers, and it is utility ratepayers. It's all of us. And who is paying for it in terms of poor health? Just one statistic out of this memo, which is actually pretty, has a number of compelling statistics about these impacts. One is that as of mid-August 2016, not even a full year, 250 health advisories have been issued due to harmful algal blooms. So I just want to, remind you all, and many of you all know this and have been very active, it was the media photos of the Ohio Cuyahoga River on fire that moved Americans to address the water quality crisis of the late 1960s and led to the 1972 Clean Water Act. And then to make sure that it worked, the Clean Water Act brought the Great Lakes and waters nationwide back to life. And I feel we are really at a similar juncture with respect to clean, safe drinking water and healthy rivers, lakes, and bays right now. So I urge you to continue to report on these twin threats of aging water infrastructure and excess nutrient pollution, and also, importantly, the opportunities for all of us to collaboratively invest in solutions to both of these.
Thank you, Jen. Felicia Marcus is chairwoman of the State Water Resources Control Board, and she's one with Governor Jerry Brown. She's one of the faces of California's effort, the public faces of California's efforts to deal with its drought. She runs one of the agencies that's most responsive and open with the press, of which I welcome. And I recently saw a water blog that described her efforts to deal with the drought, and her being willing to do everything down to hand carrying every last salmon in the state down to the sea for release. So she's also with her background in the EPA, she's involved in, has a long history of implementation of the Clean Water Act, and I understand she's also involved in trying to come up with a water rule for California itself and dealing with the struggles of what waters do you have jurisdiction over, which ones do you control, and how do you define a wetlands and things like that. And I'm pleased to hear from her next.
Great. Thanks very much, Ellen. I'm glad to be here. I am really unhappy that I had hearings I had to be at Thursday and Friday, or I would have, you know, been at the sessions, which seemed really, really good, and I really appreciate being invited to this one. They're really great. It's also kind of nice to be at a conference where I don't have to talk about the drought, the Delta, or water conservation. Yes. So, thank you. Part of what I thought I'd do, since I'm going third, is just to try and probably throw more in rather than clarifying. There are a lot of places to go on this, and I think I probably could agree as we go through the discussion with some of what both of the speakers may say. So let's see if I put something on the table that Mr. Duarte, I think, will agree with. We'll see. And I came up with four overall points I wanted to put on the table for you, and I'll illuminate them a little bit, but then, since we're trying to be brief, figure out what it is you all want to talk to. I'm always trying to think about what helps you all write a story when you have to do so many of them now and do them so quickly, and sometimes it's very hard to see the different angles to it. So I'm not saying write these stories. I just tried to think of it in terms of what's interesting about the heat and light and thunderbolts and all of that, and the war of words that you get around wetlands in general, let alone the Clean Water Rule. And as an ex-EPAer who actually had to try and implement the rules as they were before, I have a lot of sympathy for those in the regulated sector who feel like they're playing whack-a-mole with government. And I think trying to bring clarity to it, as US EPA is trying to do with the Clean Water Rule, and as we're trying to do at the state level, as I'll explain, is actually in the interests of both folks who want to protect wetlands and folks who are going to be subjected to those rules, so there can be some certainty, some planning, and some basis for actually having a conversation. Right now, as is true in much of the water arena, people tend to talk past each other. You know, is so, is not, you're a jerk, no, I'm not. And generally, even folks who've been enforced against don't present it as calmly as Mr. Duarte just did, and I understand that. You have to be empathetic. It is very frustrating to be regulated when you don't understand why or things don't seem to make sense. And so let me just lay out four sort of key points in looking at wetlands. One is, appearances definitely don't tell the whole story. I'm going to come back to that. That appearance thing is actually very important. A lot of environmental writing, you can talk either about rivers catching on fire or about the beauty and majesty of Yosemite or even of certain things. When you get to wetlands, sometimes yes, sometimes no. And that is something that needs to be acknowledged in the public policy discourse as well, because it can lead to problems. The second is, there were also fights, and Mr. Duarte didn't raise it, but some of my colleagues and I have spirited conversations, not fights. I don't really fight with – I have fought with people, but I don't really fight with people. But I actually, you know, when I interviewed for this job, I told the governor I'd probably drunk more alcohol on behalf of the environment than anybody knew, because for me it's just going and talking to real people on all sides of something, and you get a much different story about what the issue is than if you just talk to your own folks and go, yeah, we're all right, and they must all be venal or stupid. It's the world's more complicated than that. So sometimes the fights are about more than wetlands, whether wetlands are important or not. Sometimes there is a legitimate difference in ideology about what the role of government is. And there are times, because of so much that's hitting agriculture in particular right now, it feels, you see the words war on agriculture, and I see why it feels that way, because a whole bunch of kinds of rules and things that hit industry and municipalities in the 80s and 90s and even early 2000s are all hitting ag all at once, and it's not, it's definitely a business, but it's also a calling. It's probably the hardest job out there, and the margins aren't predictable. They're subject to commodity rules. So the feel of this is difficult, and it frequently can feel sometimes like folks should be able to do with their land what their land can do, which is a good thing, grow food or whatever it is. It's not always agriculture. And I think that difference in the role of government can muddy the waters, so to speak, of the conversation. And those are legitimate conversations, just as they were in water conservation, about whether the state should tell a local agency what to do. There was a lot of big feelings, as you remember, in that. And that's because there's a legitimate argument that's up to the locals. Leave us alone. Let us rise or fall on our own. There's something analogous that happens there that I think can color the conversation. And government, frankly, doesn't help with this by the way we talk about it sometimes and by the lack of clarity to regular people of the way we write and talk and even regulate. And that sort of brings me to my third point, but it's also a reason why the Clean Water Rule is actually EPA's attempt to try and do something good that actually limits them, but it's not being portrayed as such in the civic discourse. So the third point is the thing that makes it really difficult is this is an area in which the rules are even less clear and have seemed less clear, whether it's your dredge and fill rules that allow people to pull the Sierra, what'd you call them? De minimis is what you call the
Sierra de minimis. De minimis. The mini mountain ranges.
The mini mountain ranges, yeah. You know, we're talking in our own language. Even in the federal, what you'll see in these cases, and I did have to deal with this when I was EPA regional administrator, and it was even more frustrating to be in it, frankly, than to be on the outside of it, because it's kind of a weird bank shot thing where EPA sets the rule but doesn't really implement it all the time. It's the Corps that implements it. So we spend an incredible amount of time fighting with the Corps and threatening a veto to try and leverage a better rule from the Corps. That's the stuff you don't see that comes out. It's just mind-numbing because you can't just decide to do a regulation and implement it. But the way we write some of these things, it's really hard to explain. And part of that is because wetlands are hard to define, as we've discovered, even trying at the state level to do it. But the less clear you are in regulation and guidance or whatever your tool is, the more people will always read the most negative thing into it. I mean, the same as, you know, conversations with your spouse, the same thing can happen. It's just in conversation, people will read the most negative thing into it. So if our rules aren't clear and the subject matter is hard to be clear on, there's more room for that kind of talking past each other and havoc. And I'll talk about that a teeny bit. The state rules can differ from the federal rules, of course, and that's what we're working on now. And that whole state-federal interaction can be a little bit complex, but frankly, we relied a lot on the federal Clean Water Rule and those so that we wouldn't be duplicating effort where the Fed stepped in. And when the federal government started stepping back because of court decisions, we were given direction by then, this is back in the Schwarzenegger administration, to come up with a state rule. We didn't even have it. We don't define waters of the state. We don't define wetlands as a state. We've kind of drafted under the federal or used our other rules, which are our dredge and fill, our Porter-Cologne is the state waste discharge requirement rules, where we have a lot more flexibility than we do under the federal rule. But again, because we have that flexibility, our regions, which is where our stuff is implemented in the first instance, kind of have a lot of flexibility to call it where they see it. And they like that. The problem is that doesn't give any certainty to the environmental community, who doesn't trust that there's always going to be someone there they like or even that there are people there they like now. And it certainly doesn't give any certainty to folks in agriculture or any other industry who see the regions doing different things. So that's not just in theory. That also feeds into a feeling that we're arbitrary about it and that it's not a sort of a principled approach to something, and that feeling that people in the regulated sector get plays into the level of discourse and the conflict and why an individual case can become difficult. So those are the four key things. I'm not going to go through them all in depth. I'll just add to a little bit of, with an eye towards the stories you may write about this, well, not this, but about the topic. One is the appearances thing is really hard. I was thinking last night about, I'd been a public interest lawyer working mostly on sewage stuff, so I always love when people mention sewage. I'm a sewage girl from way back. I remember how to say, I'd done a lot of different jobs. I got quoted once saying, you know, I've done garbage and toxics in air, but sewage was my first love. So anyway, it's very real, and it's really interesting, actually. But this isn't about sewage, sorry. So there I am, a public interest lawyer. I think by then maybe I was actually running the Public Works Department in L.A., which is a weird story all its own, and so I wasn't practicing. But in my neighborhood, I happened to be right next to a wetland, one of the last remaining wetlands in L.A. County called the Biona Lagoon, not the Biona wetlands that folks have thought about, but Biona Lagoon. And people in my neighborhood were going to a community meeting to argue about someone who wanted to build some homes in on this lagoon, which is a ship channel, kind of a channel that comes out of the Venice canals and empties into the into Marina del Rey. And I said, well, I can't get engaged in this either because I'm not practicing because I live here. I'm a public, whatever it was, I was like, but I'll come listen. They said, no, we just want advice. So I sat in the back of the room and I watched half the room come in and talk about this wondrous, beautiful, ecological marvel that needed to be saved at all costs. And the other half of the room saying, I don't know what these crazy people are talking about. That's a stinking mud hole, which is exactly what it looked like, and particularly at low tide. And that went on talking in parallel the entire evening. And at the end, you know, the community activists came in and they said, well, what do you think? I said, well, I have one piece of advice for starters, which is those guys think you're crazy. I know what you're saying, but you should at least acknowledge, I know it looks like a stinking mud hole, but this is what the value of this resource is, as hard as that may be, just to have an even human conversation, because they spent the whole time thinking you guys were somehow looking through a set of glasses or visual, you know, virtual reality. I didn't know that word then, but virtual reality that, you know, you were seeing something totally different. Happens in vernal pools all the time. Mr. Duarte's thing talking about it is very kind compared to the way I've heard them described, even in some of the most impressive vernal pool complexes in California. So there's this appearance thing that's hard. Also, for those of you not from California, I've also stood at the mouth of the Tijuana Estuary with folks from the estuary programs, you know, folks in the Chesapeake, Albemarle, Pimlico, Pamlico, people who have estuaries that are, well, wetter than ours, and have the biologists talk about this incredibly rich ecosystem in September. And I kid you not, all of the people there, except for the Californians, were kind of doing this the whole time while he was talking. So I interrupted him and said, you've got to explain, these do get wet sometimes. And they do briefly, you know, sort of like that tundra flourishing. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'll mention it. Well, I'll just mention it briefly, and then I'll wrap up so that we can talk about what it is you want to talk about. Vernal pools are these. They're interesting in that they're these depressions. There's some people call them prairie potholes, but those are things of their own. You can explain all of this stuff more technically than I can. This is where I do environmental work, but I am from the valley, so I'm like every woman. They are depressions that end up blooming when they do get a certain amount of water in certain years, and there's this incredible rush of life in them. There's circles of wildflowers, fairy shrimp, all kinds of critters that are very important, not just in their own right, but as a food source for other critters, birds in particular, which actually does lead me into the point on this I wanted to leave you with. And Jan talked about some of them. Wetlands have this incredible value. I mean, some people call them nature's nurseries, where critters spend an incredibly important part of their life cycle in them, but they also create the food for all kinds of critters and others. And there, so there's an incredible importance on wetlands that, you know, we could spend a whole half hour just talking about. They also serve as buffers and flood control buffers. We construct them for treatment, bioremediation. They're better than a lot of the big fancy whiz-bang thing. Nature can clean stuff up if you slow the flow of all kinds of things through them. It's actually remarkable. And so they're important that way. They're also important in terms of retaining moisture in uplands that will release its water later on, which is important in California water for a lot of reasons. But you actually can think about how to create more wetlands in a way that can solve remarkable problems, not just treatment. But if, you know, really interesting thing that just happened, and Jane, you may have written about it, is the Bay Area got together, and they've been working for a long time, looking at how the whole movement has been to not fill a single square meter of the Bay. It's been one of the heroic fights. You've written about that a lot, starting with Save the Bay there. Now folks are coming together to figure out how to fill the Bay by creating tiered wetlands as a much better buffer against sea level rise than seawalls. It's fascinating, and they just passed a parcel tax to tax themselves $500 million to start doing it. I mean, and it's wetlands that are going to be able to do that while creating the multiple benefits of habitat and for fish and birds and all that. In California, we've lost 90% of our wetlands. We've lost a higher percentage than anywhere else, and we need that function. If it weren't for the rice farms in the Sac Valley, the Pacific flyway birds would be toast because we've lost all of our wetlands where they stop, they rest, they eat, forage for food, etc. So you have the rice fields and farmers in the Sac Valley who have done an amazing job trying to work with birds and now fish. And then you have the Salton Sea, which is an accident, but thank God it's there, and Imperial County and Irrigation District are trying to save it too, because that gives another bus stop for the birds on the Pacific Flyway. If we didn't have that and the rice fields, we would be in much worse shape. And so there's a whole range of things in which wetlands, as unromantic as they look, are incredibly important. And the point I wanted to make here was just that we're not saving them just for the benefit of saving a fairy shrimp or saving a critter. We're saving them in terms of ecosystems, but in terms ultimately of saving ourselves. And I'm not talking about, you know, it being good for our souls, the redemptive characteristics of restoration, though those are real. It's actually because we need them and they can do things. That said, the way we implement them, and this is where Mr. Duarte and I may agree on more than he might think, we need to be clearer about it. And EPA is trying to do it with the Clean Water Rule. That's being litigated back and forth. We're trying to do it with ours, but I have to say it's hard. You know, our staff tried to do it a couple times, and they did it, and they came out with something that was really flexible. Why? Because they want to save every piece of wetland. And both the environmental community and the regulated community came in and said, this is crazy. This doesn't help us at all. They actually were saying exactly the same thing. So we've sent them back to the drawing board to not necessarily describe every single situation, because it actually is hard to do, but to at least do categories of things that are off the table, things like tire treads that things have found a home in, you know, constructed ditches that are artificial. And we've got to find some things that we actually can take off the table to give some certainty to folks so they can move forward. And the whole issue of the ag exemption, which in the and ag rules, is really a hard one, because in the Clean Water Act, but even to extent because we have followed that, prior cultivated cropland can continue to be cultivated as long as it's used, and we argue about, because farming's also important, and you don't want to make people stop what they've already been doing. Devil's obviously in the details, but there's, I could go on, but those are just a few swaths of issues that are challenging in this arena, and it's one that has gotten some glorious and thoughtful coverage. It's also one that's hard to cover, and the nutrient issue that was raised is a bit even bigger watch this space. Like next year, I would really encourage some focus on it, because the whole nitrogen cycle is challenging, and we need to figure out how to do it while we also retain farming, because we need food. And getting to the conversation about how we do this is where we need to get, as opposed to the just finding a new demon and demonizing the folks that grow the food that we then go eat. So,
thank you, Felicia. I want to open it to questions, but I want to go back to John. I know that your incident happened before this Clean Water Rule was proposed, which is the Obama administration's attempt to kind of resolve all the uncertainties about what the Clean Water Act applies to. But you've kind of become, like I said, you've become a symbol of the implementation problems. Do you see things headed in the right direction? Do you feel reassured at all when you listen to the efforts going forward to make clear to everybody involved whether what you can do on your farm?
Well, no, and thank you, Ellen. So let's play ball here. I mean, obviously there's different perspectives, and obviously we'll have but let's have a good show for you. Now, one thing I will tell you is, in our case, we have a documented legal case. We have depositions. We have discovery. We have the field reports from the agents. So anything anyone wants to say about, you know, maybe Wiggly or feels bad or this, no, No, we're bringing this down to facts, and that's one of the advantages of having a court case out of it, a federal case, proverbially, and literally, is that we now have a set of facts that can be referred to by journalists such as yourselves. I have taken reporters, Tony and I, Tony Francois, Pacific Legal Foundation attorneys here in the room. We've taken reporters up to the site to show you exactly what the biological facts on the ground are and what the farming activities did or didn't do in those areas. So that's all available to you. And
John, if I could ask you to speak more broadly about farmers, not just your case, but the concerns of farmers in general.
I will.
Okay.
The new WOTUS rule comes out, and it defines, some of the farm bureaus have taken concern with it, and they've defined the new WOTUS rule to cover, instead of the actual wetlands on a property, it could cover 95% of entire states and designate them as wetlands. We have a judge in our case, a ruling from a judge in our case, that says, although there is a plowing exemption in the Clean Water Act that includes words that your English teachers told you to never use, like plowing shall never cause a discharge, and the soil from a plow shall therefore never be deemed a pollutant. That's in the Clean Water Act. That's in the Section 404 exemptions also. The ruling now is that lifting the soil with a plow a couple inches and moving it a couple inches laterally to form furrows is now a discharge into waters of the United States. And again, that's documented fact in case. So the farmers are looking at this clean water rule, and there's over 30 places in that rule where it says defer to the agency's experience and expertise. Now recall, I've got a millions of dollar penalty leaned against my family because a field agent thought that I was deep ripping 36 inches deep, documented, and a 10-member expert team from the Department of Justice and Army Corps of Engineers came out and documented that the tillage was 4 to 7 inches deep. So there's a lot of discomfort on the part of the agricultural community that unobjective standards that defer entirely to agency experience and expertise is something that we can operate our farms by. And as people who eat, you should be concerned that farmers have no certainty in what the rules are when it comes to producing food for you and the rest of the world. Yes, sir. We have...
I'm sorry, when you speak, could you please identify yourself?
Ryan Sackler.
Hi, Ryan.
Okay.
Where does our case stand now, and where is it in the courts? A few months ago, we had a ruling back from the district court judge locally here that we had about four different summary motion rulings. One was, does the Clean Water Act exemption mean what it says? And we lost on that. We had a ruling that said, can John DeWardy be held personally liable for the acts of a corporation on this property? We had a ruling against that. So this is not only against DeWardy Nursery, but they're valuing my home because we planted wheat where wheat's grown before. We had a ruling that said when we claim that since we filed a due process lawsuit, when we got a cease and desist notice, we asked for a hearing, we asked for the facts that the cease and desist notice was based off of, we had a second enforcement letter and zero facts and zero opportunities for hearing to come, and no clarity as to whether we could even harvest the wheat crop. So that was the initial lawsuit, was a due process lawsuit, Fifth Amendment, with the Pacific Legal Foundation. After the Army Corps couldn't get that dismissed twice, they countersued us on a destruction of wetlands charge. And that's where the $10 million, whatever you want to call it, in fines and penalties comes. We claimed that that was a retaliatory lawsuit. We had documented fact that when the operator of the tractor asked the federal attorney that was investigating, why are you guys going after suing the DeWardys anyhow? The Department of Justice attorney literally said, well, they're suing us, so I guess we're suing them back. The government protected itself from the First Amendment claim we made about this being a retaliatory lawsuit under sovereign immunity, which should scare anyone that's even moderately concerned with constitutional rights. When we sue the government to assert First Amendment rights, they claim sovereign immunity in their defense, and the judge stood with them on that. So right now we're appealing on a number of fronts right now. We'll see if the Department of Justice and Army Corps would like to haul us into court, have the penalty phase of the trial as quickly as possible before any of these appealable issues are decided at higher courts, assess millions in penalties against my business. My business employs about 400 people in the Modesto area. Peak season, we're employing close to 1,000 each year. They're threatening all of these jobs. They want to haul us into court and assess the penalty phase of this trial before they get through the appeals to find out if any of these issues even derail it altogether. If that happens, then we're on the hook to bond any judgments before we go through appeal. So this court case over 40 acres of vernal pools that were planted to wheat, that have been planted to wheat dozen times before, is threatening 500 to 1,000 jobs in a family enterprise because of what I believe is a retaliatory suit.
Okay, thank you, John. I believe Jan has something to say.
I just have to respond. So I think, and there's too much there to respond point by point, but I would actually just start by saying this is an example that I think actually reflects a lot of, maybe even all four of the points that Felicia raised. And so fundamentally, I want to say a few things. One is, this is a perfect example. Mr. Duarte's case, along with a number of others that Pacific Legal Foundation and the Farm Bureau have put forward, are examples of cherry-picking facts. And what you've just heard is actually, to me, a stunning misrepresentation of both the Clean Water Act law and a very partial representation of the facts. So what I would say to you all, as you said, it is great that we have a court system where things get adjudicated in court. And I would really strongly urge you, before you report on this example or these other examples, is look at the law. I mean, the court decision out of the Eastern District of California. I've got a copy right here. It's easy to find. I think you can find it on the PLF webpage. It has a section on undisputed facts. If you do nothing other than literally read the facts that both sides agreed to, you will see that there is a broader story here. So you have to be really careful about appearances and characterizations, not only in terms of what is a wetland, but also in terms of both sides of a story. I want to just say a couple points that we are literally having to defend these types of what we've called for 30 years now, horror stories. This is an example also of where, and Mr. Duarte has referenced this implicitly, the Duarte case does not involve the Clean Water Rule at all. It predates it. Ellen made reference to that. It only vaguely relates to even the issue of Clean Water Act, Rapano, Swank, the issue of waters of the U.S. is only one small issue in the case, whether there's a significant nexus between these vernal pools and downstream waters. So the example does, this situation does not involve the Clean Water Rule, and the so I wanted to make sure you understood that point in particular. Also, if you read, as I read the court opinion, and I know, I guess another point I want to make is I'm not going to stand here and defend the way the Corps of Engineers implements the Clean Water Act. I have worked in the Corps of Engineers. Like Felicia, I know what happens. These are very complex decisions. The Corps of Engineers has something like 50,000 of these jurisdictional determinations to make every year. They're increasingly underfunded, poorly trained, and they make mistakes. And I also know for a fact that you're right. These guys do not have a good bedside manner. They do not know how to, I mean, often they are young people with could be much better at interaction with people, and I grant you that. But yeah, okay, all right. What the court decision reflects, though, is plenty of interaction for discussion and coming to a resolution, and it also reflects the fact that the Corps of Engineers went to EPA to ask them to refer this case for an enforcement action. EPA refused to do it, and yet EPA continues to be held out as the bad guy in all of these cases. So I wanted to make sure you knew that. And the Justice Department, as I understand it, only brought it in after the Pacific Legal Foundation filed this action. So just read the cases, ask the questions. Don't take one side of the story as the total story.
Okay, thank you. Let's open it up to questions from the audience. Please give your full name and who you're with. We're going to start with, under SCJ rules, we start with questions from journalists first. And the panel members who take the questions to make sure it's the people who are going to be listening to the recording know who's speaking, please make sure to repeat the question before you answer. Yes.
About the TMDL that was so controversial in the Chesapeake Bay region, the first regional total maximum daily load. I've been covering nutrient pollution in the Western Lake Erie Basin, and most of the people I talked to there were confirming, oh no, not a regional TMDL for us, please, no. So I'd just like to get your take on that.
And maybe explain the acronym, please. Yeah.
I can do that part.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, how about this? I'll repeat the question, explain the acronym, and she'll start the answer to the question. TMDL is called Total Maximum Daily Loads, and it's an approach that actually seemed and probably is a really good idea under the Clean Water Act that was starting to be implemented when I was at EPA. I think one of the first cases actually had my name in it for a while until the end of the administration. And the theory is that you look at a water body and you say, you know, what's the total maximum daily load of the pollutants coming into this water body that the water body can continue to maintain its beneficial use for the beneficial users of the water. And that includes everybody, ag, urban, fish and wildlife, et cetera. And so in theory, it's kind of like the way if you cover air, it's sort of like the way an airplane works in a way, which is like, what's the water body? What are its problems? How much stuff is going in and how much can go in and not lose the key functions you're trying to protect of that that water body? And a regional TMDL, I'm assuming, is one that goes much broader than a given water course. Is that what it is? Yeah, multiple states. Yeah, all right. Take it away.
I'm not sure I will, but I will give you my response. And so my understanding is just looking at the Chesapeake Bay, I think these total maximum daily loads, I think the underlying concept, especially when you're talking about something like nutrient pollution and which includes a lot of non-point sources as well as point sources, is the very commonsensical idea is that for a given watershed, and watersheds can cover very broad areas or very small areas, you need some mechanism if you're going to try to ratchet down nutrient pollution, among others, you've got to find a way to look at all of the sources of pollution that are loading nitrogen and phosphorus into the streams that are ultimately part of that watershed and coming down and impacting, you know, the waters at the base of that watershed. And so the idea of a total maximum daily load is it's essentially a watershed, and this is what they call it in the Chesapeake Bay. They essentially, that's such an unhelpful term. It's basically about coming up with a cleanup plan or a blueprint, as they call it in the Chesapeake, for ratcheting down particularly nitrogen levels by 40%. And so I've been just looking at the, so it can be flexible, I think. I mean, the total.
It's meant to be flexible.
The legal structure, the legal framework of the Clean Water Act can be flexible, and it can be very flexible to the point where a lot of these TMDLs actually don't work very well. But in the case of Chesapeake Bay, what you have, and I think it's important to recognize, is that you have a seven state and district area of all supporting and depending upon the Chesapeake Bay, an iconic water body, huge a part of the economy of the area. And so there had to be some way, these states had to figure out a way to allocate responsibility and ratchet down pollution among themselves. And so really dating back to at least 2001, maybe prior, they began to meet together. And EPA convened meetings of these various states in the District of Columbia, and they reached an agreement, a Chesapeake Bay agreement. And they tried to find ways to just cooperatively sit around a table and figure out how to solve this problem. And over years, that essentially it wasn't working. They were not able to get these pollution levels ratcheted down. And so, over time, they began to they built out a really strong and very intensive science-based program to actually monitor where these flows were coming from, to model, to try to figure out, all right, how can we actually do it, and to provide a really strong scientific basis for a fair allocation that would work. And really, over time, that then morphed into a total maximum daily load blueprint proposal that came out of EPA largely at the behest of those states, because they just couldn't figure out a way to do it without it essentially being an EPA total maximum daily load. So that, the long and short of it is, I guess I feel very strongly that that's a case where the upside is it was done right. It was done through collaboration. It was done over time. It was done with the idea of let's try to avoid using sticks and using Clean Water Act regulation. Let's try to work together. Let's try to make this work. And over time, just realizing that we've got to have some accountability structure and some diet that we can all buy into, or it's not going to work. That ends up being the EPA Chesapeake Bay TMDL. It gets litigated, particularly by the Farm Bureau, all the way up to the Supreme Court, and it is now considered to be a valid basis for going forward. And we consider it to be a model for how these cleanup blueprints should work.
Yeah, just to you referenced, and I totally failed in repeating the question. The question was, you said people were really worried about a regional TMDL, and so wanted us to comment on it. I think the only thing I would add to that is, in theory, if you're looking at the whole pie of pollutants, so to speak, that are going in, you can come up with the most cost-effective ways to reduce. And in some cases, you're going to have things like not effluent trading, because there's more than effluent involved, but you're able then to say, what's the cheapest way to reduce the most of this? And maybe Joe's inputs are cheaper to reduce than Mary's inputs. So collectively, let's put our money into reducing Joe's inputs, as opposed to everybody being on their own. So that's the, in theory, you can have a much more cost-effective and collegial community cleanup of a problem. Example I was talking with Brett about earlier is the way the Clean Water Act worked, very technology-based, and it tended to really be not sensitive as a sewer girl. Remember, I used to sue sewers, and then I ran one. Just really overcoming karma, overcoming your dogma. Definitely, I'm your girl. It's all a lot harder. Yeah, I've been enforced against, and I can tell a pretty good story about stupid enforcement cases. So I'm sensitive to how that feels when people don't choose it right. But in theory, this way, by looking at what you're trying to get to, you can actually get the most cost-effective solution. So, say San Francisco Bay limited for copper. Well, what the regional boards kept doing is cranking down on sewage treatment plants because they had a permit and they could. Well, if you look at where the copper's coming from, it's brake pads. And brake pads, you can't regulate everybody's brake pad. So the brake pad partnership was born. It took quite a few years. Sustainable Conservation took it over from a project at Stanford, and they got legislation passed to phase out copper because copper's not essential for braking safety. So, but collectively, they got the will to do that because they were taking more of a TMDL look, and you had the wastewater treatment plants and others going in and lobbying for dealing with the problem. So there's that. If you're pulling everybody together to deal with just the facts in a water body, you're going to come up with some more creative solutions than you would otherwise.
In the back there.
Okay.
Your name, please.
Neil Strassman, formerly Star Telegram environment writer, now a freelancer. Can states that have privacy in the Clean Water Act abandon the TMDL format? That seems to be what's going on in North Texas.
Really? So the question is whether states that have primacy means they're managing the system, and can they abandon the TMDL process if they want to? That's an interesting question. I can't give you a definitive answer. I'll say for people who don't know what primacy is, that the Clean Water Act lays out what the federal minimum standards are for things, and states can opt into implementing the federal rules in their state. They don't all do it. California has, I think, the greatest suite of them, and always had, because we're California, we came first. Clean Water Act is modeled on Porter Cologne. The same people wrote both. I mean, there's a lot of similarity, though Porter Cologne goes further, but a lot of states haven't taken the program. When I was at EPA, Arizona didn't have the clean water program. They used to just chuckle at us as we had to do every permit under federal law. Now they have the program because states tend to want the program because they have more control. It's not about green, not green, whatever. It's just you really don't want feds regulating in your state if you can do it. But when you're in the federal government, and when I was a regional, I was stunned at how much of my time was spent reviewing the state programs, were they adequate, and giving them a bunch of money to run their programs, which people don't realize, too. You have to do certain things, which is what your question presents. I don't know that you can abandon TMDLs. You know, certainly there are plenty, I had plenty of complaints when I was at EPA about the adequacy of what certain states were doing, California being one of them, but Hawaii probably winning the prize for the most complaints at the time. Oddly enough, Nevada, no, really pretty strong programs. And Arizona, it just depended on the program. So I'm not giving you a definitive answer, but I think it's an incredibly interesting question, and my guess would be not. But I'm not totally sure, and now I'll find out. So give me your card, and I'll see if I can get you the answer. Do you know the answer? If so, I just wasted a lot of people's time.
No. I was actually going to turn back because you're doing a wonderful job and you know a lot more than I do. This is not my area. That's not my area of expertise. But my understanding, and I was going to sort of ask this back, is that, you know, maybe it's a clarification. I mean, my understanding is where a state has primacy in a case like that. I mean, Chesapeake Bay was, I think, unique because you had this
multiple states
action. Yeah. But generally speaking, the TMDL in a state that has primacy is going to be really a creature of the state, mm-hmm. right? And as a way of satisfying the Clean Water Act requirement where you've got impaired waters and you've got to come up with a cleanup plan. So, right? I mean, it's not – I guess it's important because I think we tend to come at all of this discussion now with as EPA dictating things, but presumably in that case the TMDL was birthed by the state largely as a tool to satisfy the Clean Water
Act. Well, I'm not sure because this case, which was called Pronsolino v. Marcus and then became Pronsolino v. somebody else, we settled a lawsuit where environmental groups had sued us under the Clean Water Act to say we needed to implement TMDLs, and we hadn't. This is just something that the states and everybody started doing much later than authorized. So that's why I'm remembering it as we had to. I just settled the case putting a schedule and saying that we would do it, and some of the TMDLs were done by the federal government. Most of them were done at the state government. So in my true karmic thing, now I'm sitting there having to look at TMDLs to be approved, and everybody assumes I know what a TMDL looks like. It's like, man, I just signed the thing saying we'd do it, and then I left the field for a while. So I've been playing catch-up on these. So I think you have to, but I don't know how much of the detail of how you have to do them. That's why that's an interesting question.
Very significant. How significant is the Duarte case in the California ag community? I'll answer that it's very significant in the California ag community, and it's very much has national ag attention, all the way to the American Farm Bureau Federation. Farm Bureau is very concerned with Clean Water Act enforcement and the expansion of authority under the WOTUS rule. There's no question the new WOTUS rule will expand authority and increase exposure for farmers nationwide. American Farm Bureau President Zippy Duval and California Farm Bureau President Paul Wenger recently put together the Duarte Defense Fund and promoted it from American Farm Bureau to all state farm bureaus and then from California Farm Bureau to all county farm bureaus, requesting that their boards authorize direct contributions to our legal defense. This legal defense in this, you know, these wetlands that, I mean, one panelist here, not me, called it a stupid enforcement action, and another one said it resulted after the Pacific Legal Foundation filed a due process lawsuit.
I didn't say it was stupid. I said mine was stupid.
I'll apologize for misquoting.
I can only speak for
but,
my own.
Nonetheless, it's cost us over $1 million in defense costs already, and it will continue to go forward. The rulings that have come out expose every farmer in America to what I believe are simply shakedowns by regulatory agencies for settlements. We've already had reports of confidential requests for settlements out of agencies up in the Tehama County area where farmers are being told, you might have an infraction. We need to have a settlement. I know one grower told me directly they took his financial statements and the settlement request was based on his net worth. This is happening to family farmers in California now. I don't know what the implications are of this tactic for institutional investors. If you're an insurance company or teachers union and you've planted wheat through a wetland where wheat's grown before, what's the exposure there? I think on the property this fall, we're going to have the American Society of Farm Managers and Rural Appraisers California chapter have their annual meeting. I was invited back to American Farm Bureau to speak to their Council of Presidents of all the state farm bureaus several months ago. We're going to be getting national attention as the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee just issued a majority, letter to senators who have expressed concerns about the WOTUS rule but have not gotten on board with legislative action to withdraw it, documenting, I think, 7 or 8 cases around the country similar to ours where, you know, EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy has been in front of both Senate and congressional hearings saying the ag exemptions in place under the Clean Water Act will protect farmers from impacts under the new WOTUS rule. Well, our case is direct evidence that that is simply not true. Farmers nationwide with any type of wetland on their property, regardless of its farming history, are exposed to both government actions as well as prospective citizen actions, similar to what this, Felicia Marcus was just documenting. So, yeah, the case is very significant, both in how it's gained attention from farming interests around the country. It's also very significant in implications for farmers and other landowners throughout America.
Jana, I was going to ask you too. You spoke a little bit about, kind of the situation for habitats, but could you explain kind of the flip side of it? There's the farmer's concern on the other, on the one hand. What's the need for it in terms of habitat protection on the other hand? And listening to this discussion, I can't say I'm optimistic that the Clean Water Rule is necessarily going to resolve all the uncertainties about or the disputes about what land and what waterways the protections extend to. Do you feel any optimism on that point?
Well, let me capture a few things here. So I think that the issues that are raised in Duarte, which is one of the case studies that is put forward, again, I think in kind of a cherry-picking way by the Senate Environment Public Works Committee report that John mentioned, they go to the heart. These are issues that have been an issue in the Clean Water Act since the act was passed. So dating back to 1972 and continuing, there has been a huge and very generous exemption for normal ongoing farming practices. It's in the statute. And that's what Gina McCarthy was saying. There is nothing in the Clean Water Rule that affects that or limits it. And in fact, the Clean Water Rule adds some additional exemptions. The concerns that are being raised, I'm not saying they're not valid. You know, there is this basic question of the extent to which agricultural practices, where they actually drain and fill new wetlands or channelize new streams, should be covered by the Clean Water Act. But that has been an issue ever since 1972. It became an issue in 1977 when this very issue was litigated in Congress and debated in Congress, and Congress reaffirmed that the importance of these resources, the importance of wetlands and streams in the headwaters are and throughout the watershed are so important for all of the functions that Felicia's already referenced, that we do need to continue to regulate them. But we are going, and it was in 1977 that Congress added these very clear exemptions for agriculture. But they weren't 100% never under any circumstances. I mean, that any farmer can do anything he wants to do on his land and that it will be exempt from the Clean Water Act. It's never been a carte blanche to do whatever you want in the water bodies on your land. And so these are issues that are legitimate issues, but again, they've been legitimate issues since 1972. And I'm not being as pointed as I should be, but I think that's what's going on here, is that this is not about the Clean Water Rule. The Clean Water Rule will, in fact, actually limit that jurisdiction and limit that exposure more than it has been. Mm-hmm. It's just that the megaphone, the Farm Bureau and the Pacific Legal Foundation, and the political environment we're in with the media in the state that it is in has had a huge megaphone to make it seem as though this is some sort of a new debate. And just to your point, I would just say that, you know, there are when you look at this nitrogen, when you look at this nutrient pollution problem, I'm from Florida. I see the special places I grew up with turning into slime. The springs, the bays, it's horrific. And I know that a lot of what's happening there is related to agriculture. And there are a lot of people, you know, your immediate reaction is to go, hey, tourism is a huge deal in Florida. My brother works in tourism in Florida. Why aren't you guys holding everybody accountable and fixing these problems? And there are a lot of people out there that say, why on earth does agriculture get a complete free pass from these pollution problems? My sense is that it is appropriate that we have these normal farming exemptions. That is the law. Nobody is limiting that. But there is also a real fundamental issue, again, I raise, of, you know, people taking responsibility for that pollution.
Can I just add one short thing? Just for, there are two different things. I do agree that the waters of the U.S. rule is a different issue than the case. And I never refer to it as WOTUS. I know people do, but I promise you I will do all I can to not have a Watts rule when we do the waters of the state rule. I do not want that acronym. I'll work. A WOTUS sounds a little better than Watts.
No, it doesn't.
Watts? It sounds like something John Oliver would say. But it, with respect to the enforcement case, I do need to say something just to be clear. It's important. Is I'm not opining on the case that Mr. Duarte is talking about, because I shouldn't, because I know you have actually had some engagement. I tried to look a little bit into it. I have not been involved, and it's something that could eventually, because it's in California, stuff could come to me, and I'm the appellate body. And sometimes we uphold regional boards, and a lot of times we don't. And in enforcement cases, there are even brighter lines. I just want to be clear. I can give you stories about enforcement cases from the state and federal government when I was at the local level or a public interest lawyer trying to get them to bring it that I thought were inexplicable decisions. I can also give you ones that are good ones. But the ones that are hard to explain make it hard, because it does create – this case is a big deal out there, because it feeds into a perception that is of concern on a much broader set of issues, and it's also where I think government in using its enforcement powers needs to think very carefully about what it's choosing for deterrent and general deterrent, and how it engages folks. So I'm not afraid of enforcement, but I think thoughtful enforcement is really important.
I do want to give a chance for more questions, okay, if that's okay. So in the checked shirt there.
I don't think it would have been anything but worse. How would the Duarte case have been different had the WOTUS rule been in place at the time of our farming activities? Well, the Clean Water Act does exempt farming tillage, normal farming practices, and there's no words in the Clean Water Act or the Section 404 exemption that say anything about ongoing or continuing. Farm operations have to respond to markets. There's a reason this property wasn't planted to wheat for a couple decades. It's because the price of wheat was very, very low for a couple decades. When the price of wheat was up and the world needed food, we answered the markets and we played within the national food security policy and began to produce food on a ranch that was demanded. The only thing the WOTUS rule would have done in this case would have made more of the property jurisdictional wetlands for the Army Corps of Engineers and EPA to regulate. So instead of talking about 40 acres of problematic tillage through wetlands, we may have been talking about 300 out of 450 acres of property that would have been deemed a wetland, leaving whatever balance of it, if not for a durable and usable ag exemption that takes into account market realities and farm business issues, the ground would have been virtually unfarmable under the new WOTUS rule. None of our activities, the Clean Water Act is very clear, as Janstead stated, that we're not allowed to destroy wetlands. You can farm the wetland, but you cannot convert the wetland to an upland. That's where this Sierra de minimis come from. That's why we're seeing in the Department of Justice report that our tillage, you know, per the experts, federal experts, they're claiming the top of the plow furrow is now a converted wetland to an upland, and the bottom of the plow furrow, 5 inches down, is still a wetland, even though wetland biology has completely established itself across these vernal pools since our farming activity just a few years ago. So please be clear. All this information is available. You can look at the Department of Justice report. I can show it to you. It's fun. Where they talk about normal farming programs and normal crop rotation procedures, we literally have excerpts from a Sears and Roebuck 1900s farming guide in the Federal Department of Justice expert report explaining to the judge and I guess the rest of us what normal crop rotation might be 100 years ago.
I just want to very briefly, you asked the question, would it make a difference between before and after? And I think the answer here requires a really a fact-specific look at the situation on the ground. At Mr. Duarte's case, and I know from my knowledge is the court decision, and it. So I've got a sense of the location and where these vernal pools are, and so my sense of it is that the clean water, there really would, the big difference between the two, there would be no more, I don't believe it is accurate. I don't see any basis for saying that the Clean Water Rule would pick up more. In fact, it may actually pick up less waters because of some particular farm exemptions that were sort of added in. But either way, the main difference is that under the existing situation, we're working with a set of guidance, and the decision in the case was made based on Bush-era 2008 guidance document. The main difference between that guidance document and the rule is that for certain types of water bodies, for tributaries and adjacent wetlands, the rule would just say, okay, if it's an adjacent wetland or if it's a tributary, then it's going to be covered, as opposed to the Rapanos guidance, where you have this very time-consuming back-and-forth, case-specific decision. But I really think, based on what I've seen, it is very fact-specific, and I think just roughly, if anything, the rule might result in less jurisdiction in this particular case, but not more.
Okay. We have time for one last question, I think, if we've got.
We've beaten you into submission.
Tim Wheeler with the Bay Journal. I wonder if part of the issue here, maybe the what you're describing about the fraught history of this, is it possible to make this work out any differently anyway? But do you think EPA did a really, in particular, did a very good job of explaining this rule when they first unveiled it? I had a panel discussion much like this one 2 years ago with Alan Galinsky.
I mean, I can't. Yeah, the question is. I left on January 20th, 2001 at 9 a.m. That was when as I watched the swearing in, my voicemail box got turned off. I was sitting at home because it was Saturday, but it was, when the administration changed, we all, it doesn't always happen that way, but we did. Maybe one guy stayed. One guy did stay, but everybody else left. Yeah, the question had to do with, Tim's question had to do with whether the EPA did a very good job in rolling out the Clean Water Rule and whether it was clear. You know, it's interesting because I wasn't focused on it at the time. As I tried to say, this stuff is complicated to talk about, and there's a lot of jargon and wonkiness. And when you're having been in and out of agencies, it's kind of when you start talking in that jargon that you can finally start trying to really help people how to not talk in jargon. Thank you, Ellen, for the comment. I've spent a lot of time with my own agency trying to figure out how to put into plain English that a regular person would understand what it is we're trying to do, and I have to say it's really hard to do. But in thinking about today, I actually went and I looked at some of their fact sheets on the Clean Water Rule and all of that, and they actually did a better job than I remember in my day of trying to explain what it was and what it wasn't. They even have they have like three separate things. They have the fact sheet, but they also put out an additional thing that may have come later, or maybe it's more recent, of sort of answering those frequently asked questions on what it is and what it isn't. So I don't want to give them a grade on a scale, but I think I was pleasantly surprised by how much they had tried. But if you did a whole panel and it couldn't be explained, some of that has to do with the challenge of the way the system works, particularly for EPA, where, when you're in an agency, you work within your authorities. And sometimes your authorities are really hard. You can't just go fix things. If you ask me what I wish I could do, I wish I could just make sure everybody had clean, safe drinking water in California. That's my top priority, and that's why I was happy to have the drinking water program move to us. But I don't have all the tools to do it. I can't do it. So I'm having to try and do it in all these. So you feel like when you're answering questions, sometimes you feel like the point on your head's going to go through the ceiling tiles. And so figuring out how to translate the authorities under which agencies work to common sense is really hard because you can't just apply common sense. You have to work within your authorities. And I know that
that is an occupational hazard, so it may have happened. Whether it's all about enforcement or not, I don't actually, I think enforcement is always a piece of, if you're going to have a rule, you need to have enforcement for credibility. You want to have clear rules because it's easier then to enforce. You want to have clear rules because it's, more importantly, easier for people to anticipate where the sideboards are and go about their business knowing what the speed limit is. But
we have to end it there. Thank you very much to the panelists and to the audience members and to SEJ. Thank you.